Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Hi to all, it's Dani Kvyat here, and you're listening to the Beyond the Grid F1 podcast.
Hello friends, and welcome to another edition of Beyond the Grid. It's Tom Clarkson here, and as you heard at the top of the show, this week we've got a revealing conversation with AlphaTauri's Russian rocket Daniil Kvyat coming your way. Before that, though, I do hope you're all keeping fit and well and managing to stay positive in these difficult times. Hopefully it won't be too long before we're all racing again, but in the meantime, we have an hour of escapism coming your way. Now, under normal circumstances, Dani Kvyat would be about to celebrate his 100th Grand Prix, but there's way more to this guy than mere numbers. He's a driver I've always admired because he's a bit different. He runs much deeper than many of his rivals, and he has a mental resilience to match the best. Something you need if you're a part of the Red Bull Young Driver program, as he'll explain. Of course, Danny's always been quick, as his three podium finishes will attest.
Just two more corners to go here at the Hungaro Ring. It is for Dani Kvyat, a first ever podium in Formula One. Congratulations to him.
Well done, Dani. You know what a podium means, so great job today.
He stacked up well against Jean-Éric Vergne in his debut season at Toro Rosso, and he then outscored Daniel Ricciardo when they were teammates at Red Bull Racing in 2015. Yet he was out, demoted back to Toro Rosso after just four races of 2016 in order to make way for Max Verstappen. After, of course, those famous torpedo moments in China and Russia. Over the next hour or so, we'll talk it all through, including that redemptive podium in Germany last year, his sabbatical as a Ferrari development driver, his thoughts on Red Bull advisor Helmut Marko, and even a little bit of classic literature. Yes, you did hear that right. Given the current conditions, we were talking remotely, Danny in his bright Monaco apartment, me in the less luxurious surroundings of my kitchen. I hope you enjoy our conversation. Danny, it's lovely to have you on the show. Thanks for your time. We're having to do this remotely, of course, via Zoom. Hello, and where are you?
Hi. So I'm in Monaco right now, and I guess a bit limited with my movements like everyone else right now.
Well, what is it like in Monaco at the minute? Are you even allowed out, or what's the... It's quite strict, I was hearing.
Yes, you know, luckily, it has always been more or less allowed to be outside, close to your home, but you still are allowed to go running by yourself, of course, without any groups. Still, it is like this now, and it's a big help because in some countries, I heard, you can't really do it, so... It helps massively because just to be locked down in your apartment all the time, it wouldn't be fun. And like this, I try to do morning runs every morning to see a bit of sun. Weather, luckily or unluckily, has been great all the time, actually. And so it also helps. But other movements, of course, are very strict.
What about your sort of Formula One training? Yes, you're running, but are you able to do any weights, swimming or?
Yeah, well, swimming, you know, is not allowed. I would like to. Especially the sea looks very inviting right now. It's warmer and warmer every day here. But ordered a lot of weights, a lot of elastic bands, and able to do that. And it helps a lot, to be honest, than running. Still can do plenty. Try to run sometimes a bit more than maybe what's allowed. But still, it's important to keep in shape, you know. Especially here in Monaco, it's quite calm. So those kind of things. To be honest, it's actually a good way of training. A lot of time spending training, a lot of time for these things, which we never really have time for. And now I feel like actually really fit in everything. So it's quite cool in a way.
Now, what about a new skill? A lot of people are saying to me, I'm using the lockdown to learn a new skill. Have you managed to do anything?
Yeah, well, I got an electric guitar, which I never really touched until lockdown. I knew how to play a bit of classic guitar. And so I tried to practice as much as I could now electric guitar, and it's quite cool. It's a lot of fun. And, you know, there are many YouTube videos, YouTube tutorials to teach you some new stuff. And I'm really enjoying it. Some new songs, you know, I like a bit of heavy metal, AC/DC, Metallica and stuff like that. But try to keep the volume down because of my neighbors, of course. So
I was just going to say, how are you getting on with the neighbors at the minute?
No, well, I messaged them and I said, look, guys, I got an electric guitar here, an amp, and if it's too loud, just text me and let me know. But I try never to play after 11 p.m., of course, and not start at 6 in the morning, you know?
Yeah.
And so it's okay. They said, look, during the day, honestly, you can do whatever you want. Just no problem. So I actually can quite free with that.
How much are you missing driving?
Quite a bit, to be honest. Of course, not being able to do it, not even karting, you know, not even something like that, because normally if there is a big break in the winter, I can always go karting not far away from Monaco with a friend of mine and have some fun. But right now, really, all I'm left with is a small simulator, and you know, it's not it doesn't really feel like reality. So I try to learn like new tracks and just have some fun. Learned the long version of Nürburgring in the beginning of the lockdown. Now I'm quite familiar with the track. It was not easy to learn every corner on that circuit, you know. There are so many corners.
I think there's 175 or something. So you've never driven the Nordschleife in reality, only on the sim?
I never drove, but with my father once, we went with his car. He was driving it because I was too little still to drive a normal road car. We just did one touristic lap, you know, and it was just, I can't remember, of course, any corner just from one lap. And until then, I never really touched it. And then I just said, okay, let's try to learn something new now that you have time. And now I can do maybe 3 or 4 laps in a row within like half a second. And it feels quite nice. It's very extreme track.
God, that's amazing. If you can do them within half a second, crikey. Nick Heidfeld, back in the days when he was at BMW Sauber, did 3 laps of the Nordschleife in a Formula One car. And he said it was amazing. They weren't on proper race tires, so he said he couldn't completely go, you know, flat out, but he said it was amazing.
Yeah, I mean, with F1, I don't know, there is this couple of really banking corners. I don't know, you would have to really compromise the ride height a lot there for sure, because the track also must be quite bumpy, and for that reason I think it must be quite tough in F1 car, but I bet he had a lot of fun.
Now, under normal circumstances, you would have been celebrating your 100th Grand Prix this month. It's mad,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah, I know. Yeah, I was looking forward to that, actually.
You've already done 100 Grand Prix. Well, you haven't, but you should have already done 100 Grand Prix. It's amazing.
Yeah, I know. I know. I was looking forward to it, actually. It's a nice number. And, you know, regardless, it's already quite something, you know, to realize that you've been for a while in the business. And it's cool. I just can't wait to start racing again to reach that number.
100 Grand Prix, that's more than Jackie Stewart, that's more than Jim Clark, that's more than Stirling Moss, more than Juan Manuel Fangio. I think you're a veteran.
Yeah, but at that time they had less races, of course, also per year, but still, it's like I said, it's interesting, but one number of races is one thing. You always want to, you know, win some races, some championships. It would be perfect like that. But yeah, I was thinking about it before the season starts, that it's I might be reaching 100 races this year, and it was, in a way, a good feeling.
How has experience changed you as a driver and you as a person?
Well, you know, looking back at it, like, I started joining F1 in 2013, and of course, was very young back then. And it's just a natural process, really. You know, you just go race by race, test by test, and you just grow. In a way, it's an automatic process, but also it's what you make out of every experience. It's important to analyze things deep enough, not too deep, in my opinion, and get better every time, you know. Every year there is something new. Every year you're able to, you know, you work with a new car, new engineers, there is new tires, new chassis, new aero maps and stuff like that, and you always need to figure out what's the best for you, for the car. You always need to try and always stay on top of your game, you know.
Does anything about Formula One surprise you now?
It's hard to surprise me now with anything, I think. So I've seen enough, not enough, but I've seen quite a lot in F1 these years. It's an interesting sport slash business, and it's a very competitive environment, and it's interesting. Surprised now? No, I wouldn't say so. Now I can say I'm ready for any kind of scenario. So
when you've been a member of the Red Bull Young Driver Program for ages, as you know, as you, I think you've been a member since you were 15 back in 2010. And because you don't have to worry about funding your racing career or even choosing the team, because I'm assuming that's what Helmut Marko was doing for you, in a funny kind of way, did that mean that you were less prepared for the politics and the business side of Formula One than if you'd had to fight your own corner on the way up?
No, it's not as it looks. To be honest, we always, first of all, Helmut or Dr. Marko, like you call him.
Do you still call him Dr. Marko?
No. You call him. I said Dr. Marko. I call him Helmut.
Okay.
And because one day he just told me, okay, I said, hi, Dr. Marko. And he said to me, okay, just Helmut for you now. So, and he always gave us a choice, actually. He always spoke with us, even if we are teenagers. And at that time, he still always asked my opinion. He said, look, you have this choice and this choice for next year. What do you think? What do you feel ready for? And once, you know, he asked me, I think it was before Formula Renault, a Euro Cup. He said, look, this is a very tough championship, but you also have an option to do not so tough championship if you want. And I said, no, I want to do the toughest championship there is, you know, and he let me. So I always negotiated myself with him and with Red Bull since I'm 15 years old, and also in all the karting teams. I always did it mainly myself, of course, consulting, maybe sometimes my father, because he was also involved in my karting career. But the final call, they always let me do that.
Do you think Helmut's testing you, though, when he says to you something like, you can do an easy championship or a harder championship? Is there actually only one answer to that question and he's testing you? Or do you think if you'd said to him, no, let's go and win the easy championship, he would have actually let you do that?
Maybe yes, maybe no. No, it's very hard to know what's on his mind. He's an interesting character, you know, quite unique and quite tough. I think he would let me do it, but he would expect me to win it, you know, without any competition. And if I wouldn't, then probably I would be out in that case. So, but I always wanted the toughest competition and always wanted, you know, to move forward. And I remember once, you know, he told me I would have to repeat another year in Formula Renault. Like, I was a bit upset because I wanted to move up to Formula 3. But he said, look, it's going to be best for your confidence if you win more races. And he was right, you know, even though I always want to do more, I always wanted to do as much as possible. You know, sometimes you need to consolidate your experience.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits, with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
You said he's a tough character. How much pressure did he apply on you on the way up? I mean, were there sort of threats? If you don't achieve X, we won't be supporting you next year. Did that sort of hang over your head?
Not just next year. Sometimes he would call me and say, look, if next race you don't improve, you're out. That was the kind of calls I was getting when I was 15, more or less. I think my first year.
How do you deal with that, for goodness sake?
I just had to let go. I just had to adapt. And that's what makes me better now compared to before, let's say. It's important. Yeah, I remember those. It's still clear in my head that he would call me and say, look, it's not good. You need to improve. Man, it's not good. And he just puts the phone down and then you're left with yourself. And then I improved in the next race a lot. And he said, okay, keep going. So, and like, this was pretty much all the career, you know. It becomes normal for you. It becomes a normality after some point. In the beginning, it's a bit of a shock, you know, when you are 15 and someone tells you, we will fire you. But then it becomes normality.
And do you think he was like that with everybody on the Young Driver Program? Jean-Éric Vergne, Carlos Sainz, Daniel Ricciardo? Did everybody get the same tough treatment?
I think so. I think no one, I think every, if you ask every guy, everyone would have some similar story to tell you. Not sure Carlos has, but or maybe he does as well. I don't know. You know, you should ask them. For sure, everyone would have an interesting story to tell you.
Have you got some kind of voodoo doll where you're just sticking pins into him every day or something? I don't know.
It wouldn't work, I think.
But for all of the pressure and that side of it, I mean, it's fair to say that you owe your career to Helmut Marko as well, right? There's a lot of positivity as well.
Of course. No, when I talk about this pressure and things, it's not like I'm talking in a negative way. I actually talk about it in a positive way. I think what he gave to me, to us, but I'll talk for myself in this interview from now on. What he gave me, of course, is resilience, mental resilience, and the pressure resilience that is one of the top levels, you know. It's important, and it was always fair in a way in junior categories, you know, to give chance, and you sponsor someone's career, you want them to win, and it's normal. I see it that way.
Let's not forget that Helmut was a darn good racing driver as well back in the day. He did a handful of Grand Prix. He was brilliant in sports cars. Did he ever sort of take you to one side and actually try and tell you how to drive the car as well? Or was it all sort of bigger picture stuff?
No, car, really, no. He always knew, that's another like fair play to him. He always talks with engineers first. And if there is an obvious problem that you may be experiencing with some, let's say, tire warm-up or tire usage, he would, tell you, look, this seems like it's your main problem. So try to work on this next few tests, next few races, and improve that. But he never actually tells you, like, okay, you need to take this curb here or brake 10 meters later. No, he knows exactly what his job is, and he knows exactly what the engineer's job is. So that's another thing that he's good at.
Now, look, can I take you back to early autumn 2017? And it all comes to an abrupt end, doesn't it?
Yeah, shit times.
I'm so sorry to remind you of it, but there's a positive question I want to ask you about this. I mean, well, first of all, how did he break the news, and how surprised were you by what happened?
I mean, thank you for reminding me, especially now in the lockdown times. No, but it's good to talk about it as well. I mean, honestly, it was a tough period ever since 2016, you know. It was a very difficult year and a half for me. And I lost a place, I think, for Malaysia, and then called me again for one race in Austin. I was sure at the time if I try to do as good job as I can that race, I could have a chance at least until the end of the season, you know, to try and prove it. And it was a good weekend, you know. Many things have improved. And I felt comfortable again. And the car at that point was really struggling, to be honest. But I managed to bring it in the points, and the pace looked good again. And after the race, you know, I was scheduled a meeting with Helmut. And he just told me, look, unfortunately, it doesn't work. And that's it. Simple as that. So we shook our hands. And I was very tense the whole weekend. But to be honest, when I left the room, I was relieved in a way, because it was not easy times.
Did you expect ever to be welcomed back into the Red Bull fold after that race?
No, I thought. But honestly, our goodbye was in a way very normal. There was no like no hard feelings. I never tried to pinpoint anything, and him as well. It's just two, you know, business partners. It's the way you want to see it. They just stop the collaboration, you know. Obviously, I never said anything bad in the media after that, of course. No, I didn't think about that return would be ever possible there. But life sometimes can be very interesting.
Well, so here's the positive question. I'm going to put it to you, Danny, that your year at Ferrari, hindsight's a wonderful thing, but your year at Ferrari was a real life-enhancing experience for you, and you've come back a better driver. Is that fair comment?
Yeah, I think it's fair comment, yeah. I felt like I needed a break after those a bit not so easy times, and it was very, very important, very, very nice in a way to be able to spend some time home, to just do the training to clear your head, not just for, you know, getting ready for championship, to do sometimes nothing and still, you know, think about things well. And but I had still a very job that I enjoyed in a way. It was a development driver for Ferrari, and I like, you know, Italian teams very much. Ferrari, you know, has a huge history, and also it was great, you know. I would take a car here from Monaco, drive maybe for 4 hours more or less, put my favorite music on, arrive there, do my job, enjoy some talk with the guys, and yeah, I felt like I meant something to them, you know, like it wasn't the job that I wanted, but I felt that I was giving the result to the team. I was helping to develop the car, and they felt it, you know, they felt that I was doing my best for them, and it felt very satisfying to do that job in a way, even though I wanted to drive so much, especially around May, June, when I had my rest, when I charged my batteries again, I was like, man, I just want to drive. I was starting to struggle because I wanted to come back.
What were you actually doing for Ferrari? You were on the sim, but were you the guy who over a Grand Prix weekend would work overnight to help the guys at the track? Was that the job or was it something else?
Yeah, it was that. I would do Thursday, Friday of the race weekend, try all the, you know, requests from the track, whatever we need to try. And then after Friday meetings, I would try to listen to the comment of the guys from the track and try to look other things deeper to improve the car. And if necessary, to talk directly there with the people. And yeah, it was good because, you know, people were listening to me. And I attended a couple of races, actually, also there. It was good. It was good to be on the track also with them. Of course, when you're on the track and you can't race, that was also not an easy one.
How do you rate your time in Maranello? Did you enjoy the town? Did you get a buzz out of working for Ferrari just because it's Ferrari?
Yeah, I enjoyed. I mean, the town is quite small, but I knew some people, you know, in Modena, and ironically, also my ex-race engineer from Toro Rosso, you know, Marco Matassa at that time, he lived in Modena. So hang around with him. I made a lot of good friends in Ferrari, also some race engineers, my simulator crew also. We had a few funny dinners sometimes, and it was cool. In the end, then I tested that year's car once in Fiorano, and that was very emotional for me because, you know, first of all, it's a Ferrari in Fiorano, current car, and it was really cool. And I didn't drive anything for 6 months or something, and I was enjoying it so much. And that day I understood that I want to come back at any cost, you know, to Formula One, because this is what I want to do. This is what I'm best at. And also that test was very strong, the very consistent and good lap times, and everyone was quite happy.
Do you have a feel for the history of Formula One, Danny? When you were pulling out of the Shell garage at Fiorano and pulling out onto the hallowed tarmac, did it go through your mind that the Villeneuves, even the Ascaris and all these people had driven on that same bit of tarmac? Did it mean anything?
Yeah, it did. Yeah, it did. I remember I was very nervous at the breakfast. Like, I could manage to eat only like one croissant with some coffee, and that's it. You know, I couldn't eat more. I just couldn't wait to get in the car at that time. And I was quite nervous, and I thought, okay, just try not to spin on the outlap or something like that, because I didn't drive the car for a while. I was a bit worried. But luckily, I went on track and I just started to brake later and later, and it was good.
What kind of a track is Fiorano? How many corners is it? It's a short lap, isn't it?
It's quite short, yeah, but there are many kinds of corners, you know, a bit of medium speed, high speed, quite low speed. So you got a bit of everything. It's good enough, definitely, to do a little test. But, you know, of course, it's not Spa, Francorchamps.
Yeah, sure. You say you really wanted to come back to racing, particularly Formula One, but did you think about racing anything else? Did you look at IndyCar? Did you look at sports cars or Japan? Or
I looked into it, but it wasn't the thought about it wasn't making me excited. It wasn't making me happy. I felt like I have a lot of unfinished business in Formula One. And yeah, of course, there was talks in different also areas, but I always wanted to, you know, only Formula One. I was even considering, you know, to stop completely if I don't get a Formula One deal again.
And was the option to stay at Ferrari for 2019?
Yes, for sure, yeah, because everyone was happy with my job, but they also knew that of course I won a race, and they knew I'm more of a race material, so actually they were trying to help me to find some deal also. Not only in F1, also outside. Everyone was very kind to me there. Also from the top management at that time, everyone was very understanding. Everyone would share a word with me always. And that was actually, yeah, good times. But of course, then once you're looking for a seat, you become a bit nervous, no? And when you feel like maybe you will never get to race again, then you become a bit nervous.
Did you have much contact with Seb and Kimi?
Yeah, I did. I did in Canada with Kimi. Yeah, also a little bit. he is not that much of a talk person, but many times when we would cross, he would share some words with me, because I know him, we have some friend in common from Finland, so we have something to talk about. And you know, Russia, Finland, we are neighbors, so we understand each other a bit more. And with Seb, also with him, it was great to know also to watch them work, two world champions, very experienced guys. For me, it was good to see them work a bit from outside, learn a bit, listen to them talking on the radio, listen to what are their preferences, who gets nervous, and why. So that's some things that I thought were not normal are actually normal. It was interesting to see that from outside also. It was a great experience. And there was Sebastian once, I think I was in Canada, and I think what was my job there is to look on board videos and try to, you know, pinpoint what's different. And like I said, look, I think you can take more chicane, more curb in that chicane. And he agreed, and he tried next day, and it was better. So he then said, okay, thank you. It was good advice.
Wow, that's a great story. I hear a lot of people saying that Seb has the most amazing work ethic, in that he stays late, he goes through every detail.
Yeah, very, very hard worker. Yeah, I actually really learned to kind of, in a way, admire his work. I think he's great. He's a very interesting person as well, and works really hard, very dedicated, loves this sport very much, for sure. Was very interesting to look at him like this. In that role, I picked up a few things from him.
So go on then, how did it happen? I remember seeing you in Sochi 2018 when you'd just been announced, and you had a real spring in your step. It was wonderful to see. But I mean, was it literally just a phone call out of the blue from Helmut, or what happened?
We spoke, I was speaking with people also, and I've been talking with maybe in June, I made a few phone calls to different people, and I just said, look, if you ever come to the point where you need a driver, keep me in mind. And everyone said, okay, we will. Thanks for letting us know. And
sorry to interrupt, but was that just Helmut, or was that other teams as well?
No, other teams as well. Other teams. And, you know, we were maybe, I was talking with other teams as well, but it was not even like 50%. It was something like, maybe let's see. Here and there, and I was like feeling like, it's not gonna become anything real, But then, with Helmut, is always very direct, and he just, called me when all these things with Daniel leaving Red Bull and so on started, and then he called pretty much the next couple of days and said, "Look, let's have a meeting," and we had meeting in Graz, and it was quite a long meeting, and to be honest, we kind of. When he called, I knew that it's 99% done, because he would never just call, just to have a meeting. And we spoke some details in that meeting and discussed, possible options and requirements. And it was good. It was a good chat, and I was back.
And that was during the summer break then of 2018?
Yeah, that's correct.
Oh, gosh. You really did know quite a long time before we knew.
still, it's like, we had meeting, but then there are a few other details to settle and so on. And then more of a, contractual things. And in terms of signed contract, wasn't too far away from the announcement, actually.
Now, I said I think you've become a better driver, and you didn't disagree. Where do you think you've improved in the last 18 months?
It's hard to say exactly where, but I think just was necessary to have a mental break, mental charge, because I had a everything in my career developed very fast. A lot of things happened very fast, faster than I expected them to happen. And sometimes it's just nice to have a break and look at the whole situation a bit from outside. That's what was necessary for me, because I was a bit falling out of love with Formula One, with the sport in general, the end of my first, career. And then to regain the passion, to regain the love and fire for your sport was very important. And now, I have plenty. So it was very, meaningful year. I think that's the thing. And just to be able to be a bit more mature, to judge the situations in a better way. And even when something goes wrong, because sometimes it's unavoidable, just to be able to get out of those situations in a better way compared to how it used to be for me, also was important.
Do you think there is a chance of you ever getting back into Red Bull racing?
When we giving our chat, everything in life is possible. Absolutely. After what I've seen, you can never say no to anything anymore. Of course, you know, now what I also learned is that you don't want to be, you know, dwelling or dreaming about the thought all the time. It's just important to focus on your job that you've been assigned with. And right now, what Red Bull has assigned me with is to, you know, deliver best results possible for AlphaTauri. And that's what I'm going to focus on. And this life shows, you know, everything is open to you if the results that you deliver are good enough.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Now, look, I wanted to ask you about some of your teammates. So let's start with your current teammate, Pierre Gasly. In fact, there's a lot of parallels between you and him, the sort of snakes and ladders of the Red Bull Young Driver program. How quick is Pierre?
I think, Pierre is very quick, for sure. I still didn't actually understand him very well as a driver. I still think that it will be interesting because I haven't seen the full picture still. Very quick guy, especially on one lap, you know, very comfortable. And again, it depends a lot, no? What state you are, what you drive for. And he really showed a great speed. And I always knew, and that's what I always heard of him, that a very fast guy, especially in qualifying.
What do you mean by the full picture? You think you haven't seen the full picture yet?
I just don't think now to do a full year with someone is a bit different. When you start from zero again, this year is not very full, but yeah, it doesn't really matter. He always been fast. For sure, I expect him to stay very fast this year too, when we start again. I was just quite surprised that he didn't manage to deliver the same performance in Red Bull Racing. This is what I mean maybe by full picture. I think it was a bit surprising for me.
What, because you think he's got the talent, but just couldn't deliver in the pressured environment? Or
it's hard to say. Like, again, I don't have full picture about him. I don't know him well. I don't know well how, you know, a person reacts in different situations. That's what I meant probably. For sure, everyone has talent and enough speed. Most of the drivers in F1 have that deliver. And then, yeah, of course, the environments are, every team is a very different world, you know, and it's hard to say. That's the only thing maybe I didn't understand very well. It's better not to think too deep about this.
I mean, Danny, you say every team is different. And is Red Bull Racing very different to AlphaTauri? Because, you know, you share the same motorhome. I'm surprised to hear that.
Well, it's different because it's, you know, top team. It's you fight normally for higher positions. That's what's different. And also, yeah, normally, historically, they've been faster car than our car also. It's quite obvious statement, but that's the way it is. In a way, it's same. In a way, it's different. Because in the end, what you have to do is just drive the car. So that doesn't change at all. Then the environment around you is a bit different, yeah.
Is it very different being in an English team versus an Italian team?
I think it's different, yes. I think Italians and English guys have a bit different mentality. It can work very well, I think, together if you make it work. But yeah, for sure, it's normal, no, that it's a bit different approach, no? English guys are a bit more precise, detail-oriented, but a bit more cold in the way of interacting. While, you know, in the Italian team, there is a bit more of heart, a little bit more emotion involved, a bit more home-like atmosphere in a way. But in the way, both ways can work very well, I think.
So what about Alex Albon?
What about him?
You've done half a year with him. You know, the poor guy, I think, hadn't even sat in a Formula One car prior to pre-season testing. But I mean, did he impress you?
Yeah, also of him, I don't have actually full picture because, again, I did just half a year with him too. But I kind of enjoyed working with him, to be honest. Quite easygoing personality and, yeah, good, sometimes good jokes, sometimes not so good. Fast guy, for sure, very fast guy, everyone. But when you come, you know, in Formula One, you have this rookie flow. everything comes easy to you. I think he's going to discover more and more of this world. And but he also has room, you know, because he's been a rookie last year. He has room to even improve more. So I think he has a big potential for sure.
Were you very frustrated that it was him and not you that got to replace Pierre Gasly in the team?
Well, let's put it this way. I wasn't happy for sure. I cannot say that when I heard the decision, I fully understood it and I fully agreed with it. For sure, I was a bit like, it doesn't sound right. But if you look at it in a way, it can make sense. I've been there already and they need new blood always. They need to promote young drivers. This is what Red Bull does. No, it's okay. In the end, after a few days after that, I took and accepted the decision. Fine for me. I know my job. I know what I have to do. What I was hired to do, and that's what I'm going to do. So it's enough for me like that.
And is Carlos Sainz, moving on to him, is he the guy on the grid that you know the best? He seemed to have done so much together on the way up, quite apart from sharing Toro Rosso together.
Yeah, probably, yeah. In a way, yes. I think spent most of my career and shared many teams with him. And also in junior categories, also in karting, we were rivals. So it was... maybe the guy I knew for longest, for sure, in F1. And yeah, also very talented guy, also very fast. I can say the same thing about every teammate I had, you know.
Jean-Éric Vergne, Daniel Ricciardo.
Yes, exactly. So they're all like that.
Who was the quickest?
Quickest in qualifying, maybe Ricciardo, yeah, I think. At that time, with that car, with those tires, he really found a good balance of how to drive that. And but it seems like also now is very competitive. So I think he was a bit more impressive in qualifying. But it was very good benchmark for me. It was very good. And every time like I beat him, I knew that, okay, it was a really good day for me.
Is Dan a bit of a smiling assassin? Is that a... Is that a decent way to describe him?
I don't know. No, just smiling, really. And just a good driver, you know, nothing assassin about him. I think he also made a lot of progress, you know, since he's in Formula One. I think it's normal, you know, to improve since your first year in F1. And he always managed to improve, find a good balance between qualifying and race. And yeah, that's what makes him quite a complete guy right now.
Were you surprised that Ricciardo and Sainz left Red Bull of their own volition, of their own choice?
It's hard to say. I think it's more complicated than that. You know, again, I don't want to dig into someone's past stories. There must be reasons for that. There must be motives for that that we don't fully know. And so, yeah, I don't know. I'm surprised. Maybe no, in a way.
Mm. Well, can we just talk a little bit about your past, because it's a fascinating story, Danny. First of all, do I pronounce your hometown, where you were born at least, Ufa? Is it Ufa?
It's more or less that. It's Ufa.
Ufa. I mean, how does a kid born in Ufa ever want to become a racing driver? I've looked. You've got an ice hockey team, you've got netball, you've got all these things going on, but Formula One?
Yeah, well, I mean, the story goes like this. It's... I moved to Moscow with family to study when I was 7 years old, more or less. And there on the way back from school, every time we drove home, there was a karting, rental karting center. And I was always curious to see what is that, you know, because I always wanted to drive the road car. Sometimes I always ask my father, please let me drive the road car. I want to drive it. And he said, look, let's try this then. It looks like a little cars. And I tried that and it was immediately quite fast compared to people who were going there maybe already for many months. People who worked there, they said, look, you look quite fast. So let's try to work on it.
But I mean, was Dad interested in cars? What was his job? What was it? Was he involved in any way in the motor industry? Or
no, he didn't, I think, even know what Formula One is. He has nothing to do with the cars whatsoever. Just had his local business in Moscow. And that's about it. So he didn't really know much about cars, to be honest. So I've just started by chance like this. Just no real background in there. Like many other drivers, I know they start because it runs in the family. In my case, it's really just... It just started like that.
So tell me about this decision to move to Italy, Because given that there's no history of car racing, it seems an even bigger step into the unknown than I originally thought.
Well, yeah, of course, it was a huge step, you know, to basically immigrate into another country for a sport of racing. And because once I was already doing some races in Italy, and we could see that, look, the competition level is so much higher, and there is 100 people a race, maybe there is 25, 30 in Russia. It was still a good championship, and I think now in Russia the championship is much better than it was in the past back then. But at that point, we were like, we need to move to Italy to drive on consistent basis there in Italy, in France, in Spain, you know, to become better and to be more noticed also.
Were you getting any advice from people within Russia at this time? Did Vitaly Petrov, was he helpful in any way? Or?
No, I didn't know Vitaly at that time. He was still racing, I think, in Lada Championship at that point. He also started late, you know, and I only heard of him first time, actually, when he was winning some races in GP2. At that point, I only heard him about him. But at that point in Russia, really, who was helping me, my first trainer, Pavel Guskov, he was there. And he said, look, I also think that you overgrown a bit here, the level, you need to try and win races in Italy. Then it will really make you better. So, because there is history of people who tried to race in Europe from Russia, but it never quite worked because they didn't live there. And we said, okay, we take it to another level and we move there to Italy full time.
And rarely went back to Russia, or did you commute a little bit?
Very rarely, to be honest, because the racing was full on in Italy. You know, if you want, you can race almost every week of the year. And I remember it was pretty much like this for me. If I wasn't racing, I was testing with different carts, new tires, testing, try to improve my driving, my team, my cart, and a lot of races in different tracks, northern Italy, southern Italy. So we were driving all the time around the country with my father in the car, like sometimes nights through, like do the race, drive through the night, and next day already driving on some track in the morning.
Actually, a really nice bonding time with dad, I suppose.
Yeah, I think so, yeah. We spent a lot of time together, yeah, for sure. And he drove a lot of miles because of me.
So you moved to Italy when you were 8, is that right?
No, 11.
11, okay.
11 years old. I started 9 years old in karting, actually, and then only 1.5 year in Russia and then Italy.
Okay, because I was going to say, you know, do you actually feel more Italian or more Russian?
You know, still, you know, Russia is a big part of me, and still it's the language that's original in me, and maybe most thoughts, they still come there. But I spend a lot of time in Italy since I'm young, so I got a lot of, you know, features from Italians. I spend a lot of time with Italian guys, Italian teams, and it left a huge mark. It's a huge part, you know, of my heart, for sure, that country. I love both countries, so.
Can you just tell us a little bit about what it was like to spend the first 11 years of your life in Russia? I mean, what was it like in the late 80s? The
late 80s.
Yeah, in the late 90s. Yeah. Well, before you were born, what was it like? No. What was it like in the late 90s, early 2000s? You know, it was Boris Yeltsin and then Putin, of course.
Yeah, I can't remember that. You know, I remember early 2000s. How was it? I don't know. The country has been going through some changes, I think. I think now it's actually, it grew quite a lot. It became always more and more modern. If you look at the country, always felt like it was a little bit behind in the beginning of 2000s. But now, like technologically talking, but now it feels like it's more or less, it's more advanced, like Moscow and St. Petersburg are the cities where people go comfortably as tourists.
And was it sort of Ladas, Trabants, Skodas everywhere? Can you remember any of that?
Yeah, I remember. Yeah, many Ladas. And now, yeah, not so many anymore, for sure. They looked a bit out of date, but now there are new cars producing, luckily, so they look a bit better.
You weren't tempted by the... Did you say that Petrov did the one make Lada championship? You weren't... A one-off appearance.
I don't want to lie about his past, but yeah, I think he did Lada. So also quite impressive career he had. He started in Lada Championship without karting, nothing, and the guy made it to the podium in Formula One, you know. So quite an impressive story too. I think you should talk with him next on your podcast.
Interesting. Yeah, yeah. But I mean, because you were always on the road, quite literally with your dad, I guess there was quite a lot of homeschooling. Is that what happened?
Yeah, there was a lot, and he would always be angry with me. He said, "Look, you can't study for shit. Like just
your dad would say that. This.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Just look, I let you do karting, but you need to study." So he would examine me, you know, on history, on maths, and on other things, and he would say, "Look, it's lucky you know how to drive the car." So, but it was hard. It was hard to study on the track sometimes because I just had no focus, no spare brain to study. You know, I would be thinking always about this corner, that corner, what setup we should go with, what tires we should go with. And that's what was on my mind. I was a lot more interested in what was happening on the track than in school. But I still managed to study quite a bit. Something stayed in my memory, and yeah, it's challenging, but you have to manage somehow.
So where did your passion for classic literature come from? Because, I mean, I've spoken to you before about War and Peace, Tolstoy, but also Dr. Zhivago, Pasternak. There's all sorts of books that you've read. Is it true that you're now reading Marcus Aurelius?
Yeah.
Is this a passion that's come from your dad, or where? Is it? Do a lot of Russians read classics? I read that somewhere.
I really don't know where it came from, to be honest. It's not like my parents are great readers. You know, they read something, but not much. And maybe they were just saying to me when I was young, "Look, you don't read enough. You need to read more, maybe." And maybe I said, "Okay, let me try." And I started to read something. And actually, I was like, "Okay, that's interesting," you know. And I started to get a bit more hooked up on those kind of classic stories. And yeah, you know, luckily in Russia, we have a lot of great writers. And so I have a lot of choice from the classic literature. And yeah, I read plenty of books. People maybe think that I read everything, but I didn't. I read the ones that you mentioned, but it's quite already heavy stories. So it's enough for now.
Yeah, but how many Formula One drivers have read Tolstoy? I reckon you're the only one. I think I'm safe to say that.
We can challenge them to read it as well.
Now, Meditations by Marcus Aurelius. Using that as a theme, my next question to you is, I've heard you say that training is like meditation for you. What do you mean by that?
Well, in a way, yeah. It frees a bit your mind. It takes your maybe focus away from maybe if something hasn't been going the right way in your day. And I prefer boxing, to be honest, for that. If you're having a shitty day and maybe you're a bit thinking about problems too much, and then I just go in the ring and I do some pad work, some heavy back work, and sometimes some sparring, then it really takes away all the mental stress a bit for me personally, and I manage to disconnect from these problems.
How long have you been boxing?
You know, not much. Started when I was 23 years old, maybe. So maybe like started to do lessons more or less consistently again with the schedule, and everything is tough. Maybe last 2.5-3 years, no more. But I really enjoyed it straight away. And also there, you know, I feel like I keep improving. And it's important because when you keep improving, you're always curious to know how far you can go. And of course, it's a very tough sport. It's if you have mental pain, but add a very strong physical pain also to that. And it's you get boxing.
Has your upper body strength improved quite a lot since you've been doing it?
Yeah, it did. It did. And luckily, it's also a very good workout because it helps your body endurance in general, your coordination. This sport forces you to dig deeper, you know, into yourself when you're really tired. Yeah, of course, upper body endurance for shoulders, for example, is also very related to our sport now. So it helps. It's pleasant and it's also useful.
Rakuten is the smartest way to save money when you shop, because members get cash back at over 3,500 stores across every category, including fashion, beauty, electronics, home essentials, travel, dining, and more. Your favorite stores like Lenovo and Wine.com pay Rakuten a commission for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the commission with its members, and that could be you. Cash back is deposited directly into your PayPal account. Or, if you prefer, Rakuten can send you a check. The choice is yours. You can even maximize your savings by stacking cash back on top of other deals, like store sales and coupons. You're already shopping at your favorite stores. Why not save while you're doing it? Membership is free and it's easy to sign up. Get the Rakuten app now and join the 17 million members who are already saving. Cashback rates change daily. See Rakuten.com for details. That's RAKUTEN. Your cashback really adds up.
With new McValue at McDonald's, you get more than you expect. So after a long day, buy a double cheeseburger and add a McChicken for a dollar. Because saving with deals is always on the menu with new McValue.
Prices and participation may vary. Valid for item of equal or lesser value.
Do you think you'd ever get in the ring properly?
Yeah, maybe. I'm thinking about this for sure. For sure. We speak about this with my trainer a lot. And yeah, I was in the shape to do maybe 10 rounds, which is quite a lot, quite clean. But it's not easy. And you need to keep training all the time there. You can't just, you know, do once a week and so on. It's a hard work and it's a physical hard work. The training camps there are really something else, you know, something we don't know about in F1. It's a very tough physical sport, like sprinting or marathons, something like that.
But I'm now worrying for you because you're now, if you get in the ring, you're going to have to take a hit or two, aren't you?
Well, you kind of, there is this possibility, but I'm not thinking about doing it now. I'm thinking about it in the very, very far away future. Maybe after F1. So not now. No. Of course, like you said, it's too easy to get injury there, whatever it is, wrists or take a bad hit. And no, of course, I cannot risk my F1 for that.
Have you met any professional boxers?
Yeah, I met last year Canelo Alvarez.
The Mexican
here
boxer.
In Monaco.
Yeah.
Yes, he's now considered one of the best, if not the best, you know, right now. And it was cool for me because usually I never show to anyone, whoever it is, time on Saturday before qualifying to show the boxes, to show the steering wheel and the car. When they told me that Canelo is here and he doesn't speak any English and so only Spanish, and I speak luckily Spanish, I said, okay, let me do it. Like, I think I will really enjoy this. So I showed him around, and he's a very nice guy, also very humble, very easygoing. It was really cool. It was really cool.
That's awesome. And talking of your training camps, better than a coronavirus camp that Helmut was talking about sending you guys on a few months back. Was that a real thing?
No, I don't think so. I think sometimes, you know, unfortunately, words get a bit interpreted in a bad way. And maybe they took this interview like a while ago. And maybe at that time, it wouldn't sound so strange. But at that time, when they published, maybe it sounded a little bit different. I don't think he really meant that. No, I think he just wanted the best for us. He wanted us to train together, just not to get bored. That's maybe what he meant. But you should ask.
No, look, it's been wonderful to chat, Danny. I wanted to just end by asking you about your podiums. You've had three podiums, just to remind people listening, Hungary 2015, China 2016, and of course that amazing one last year in Germany. Which of those three is your favorite?
Tough one in a way, because first podium is always very memorable, no? But it was with Red Bull Racing, and even though you were struggling with the car, at that point, that podium meant a lot also for the team. Also because Daniel finished third, so it was double podium for the team. Everyone was quite happy that day, I remember, in Red Bull. We started to have some hope after that day. And maybe 2016 podium, I was already very tense at that time. I was feeling that, you know, it's there was not a good air around me in Red Bull Racing. And even though I did the podium, I wasn't feeling very confident it would change something. Unfortunately. And of course, then the podium in 2019 in Hockenheim with Toro Rosso was most special, I think, because it feels like an achievement per se, because to bring the team back to the podium, the team that never had the podium for 11 years, it was something very special for me. It was emotional day. Already that just alone makes me feel proud.
It is fireworks and flames for Max Verstappen, the winner of the German Grand Prix. Sebastian Vettel from 20th to 2nd. And keep the applause going for Danny Kvyat, a third podium in Formula One.
So each podium has its merit, but in which race do you think you drove best, each of those three?
Hockenheim. So in Hockenheim, was able to, you know, keep the head cool in these difficult conditions for the whole race. It was very challenging not to make any mistakes that day. It was very difficult conditions, and to to make a right call to go on the slicks was crucial, you know. And usually in those kind of races, until that year, I would be a bit lost. But that year, I managed to really keep my head cool all the race, all the distance, and it really paid off massively. But to be honest, all of three podiums, I always felt like I could have driven better. Sometimes, so it's funny. It's a funny feeling. You're like thinking, you didn't drive maybe your best, but you managed to still, you know, get a strong result.
So you, in 2015, you beat Daniel Ricciardo in Hungary, and you still think you could have driven a better race?
Yes, for sure. Yes, for sure. I remember I wasn't happy with myself, to be honest. I wasn't happy with the way I drove in qualifying. I wasn't happy in the race with my tire management. Safety car gave me a chance, you know, to restart the race, and I managed to make good overtakes and find the pace all of a sudden, and it was good. But if I had done this race again, it would have been another race, I think. Even, you know, would have been able to challenge for more for a win.
But overall, in 2015, are you satisfied with what you did? Because you outscored Daniel by 3 points.
I was satisfied. I had the feeling it was a good year. But, you know, I'm like this, I'm never really fully happy. I always think I could have done a better job in many occasions, in many places, in many qualities, in many races. I always feel that. Maybe 2019, there was definitely more races where I felt, okay, you managed to achieve most out of yourself and out of the car than 2015. So I think if I had a chance again to go, you know, with top team, with top car, now with the way I am, it would be another story.
Do you think there is such a thing as a perfect lap?
Yeah, you know, I'm trying now, like on the simulator, I do one lap and I think, okay, that was a perfect lap. Then I find another tenth the next day, then another half tenth the next day and so on. Hard to say, you know, we have this little window, you know, of perfect grip conditions from the tires, of perfect wind, perfect atmospheric pressure and stuff like that. And this window, you need to use it 200% or 99.9 and so on. It's very difficult. I think you just need to do a strong enough lap to what you have.
Wow. Do you think fatherhood has in any way changed your approach, made you a better driver since the arrival of... In fact, it was Hockenheim, wasn't it? The arrival of your daughter. Has it changed your approach in any way?
Yeah, it was also a special day because of that, of course. I wouldn't say it changed my approach on the track. No, you're of course realizing that you're a father and that maybe changes your mentality a bit. But once you're on the track, you keep working on your, you know, racing driver skills. So it doesn't really overlap your personal life and what happens on the racetrack. But yeah, in life, it did, yeah.
And now that you're a dad, does it make you appreciate even more the sacrifices that your own mum and dad made for your career? Moving to a different country to support your karting. I mean, it's an extraordinary thing, really, isn't it?
Yeah, of course, yeah. Of course, I will always be grateful to my parents for what they did for me and how much they also sacrificed to move with me, my mom and dad, to Italy with me and start something completely new. It's not easy also for me. It wasn't easy to change the cultures so much. One day you're in Russia and then the next day you're between all the Italian people, and it's quite different, you know, but this whole journey has been quite cool.
Do you think if you hadn't become a racing driver, you would have sought a life outside Russia anyway?
Oh, I don't know. It's hard to say. I think I would always like to travel the world, but I don't know where my base, you know, would be. You always find your place of where your heart, where your soul belongs, you know. Many people in the world, sometimes they move to another country because they feel like they want something new, you know. It's normal. But in my case, it was more of a professional call. However, I don't know. It's too hard to say where I would be now. There is everything happens for a reason in the end.
Where do you think your soul belongs?
Right now, it's here in sunny Monaco. But yeah, Italy maybe is the country where I would like to spend my most time in. Yeah, in Italy, I really feel happy.
Brilliant. Well, look, we're hoping to go racing, what is it, beginning of July, isn't it? That's the aim,
yeah.
in Austria. Because of the lack of racing, it's a kind of weird driver market, isn't it? It's an odd driver market. When do decisions have to be made for next year, do you think?
It's very difficult, Cole, especially now with this... that we are all stopped, everything seems frozen. It's very hard to say what's really going to happen. we will speak more further on also with my manager, you know, Nicolas. We will start talking soon. Whenever the time comes, it's still to without racing, it would be with racing, sorry, it would be already a good point to start talking a bit about what might happen in the future. But without racing, really, our hands are tied, so we don't know who wants what and what the chances are. It's hard to say, and I think the same for the teams. Without racing is way too hard to make any conclusions.
I wonder, maybe we'll see very few changes as a result. I was always told, if in doubt, do nought.
Maybe.
As in, if there's any doubt, do nothing.
Maybe it would make sense, because in the end, what has changed while we were not racing?
Exactly.
Not much.
Quick word on this year's car, because of course we haven't been racing yet in 2020, but you did get out in it in pre-season testing. What was the, what do we call it? The AT01, don't we? What was it like? How did it handle?
It was, you know, quite a good feeling straight away, you know, since we did the filming day, it went smooth. So we were excited to go to Barcelona. And even though regulations technically are very, very similar to last year, still, you always try to improve the car. You always try to put more downforce on it, try to maximize the suspension stuff and so on. So all our engineers and chief engineers have been working hard all winter. And in Barcelona, yeah, it was clear that, you know, car is similar in a way to last year, but also a bit different. So we had to figure out a bit the ways of how to find the right setup for it, what needs to be different compared to last year, like all these things, you know, and setup, what makes this car go fast. That was our main topic. And with more limited testing, we tried to do our best to, you know, discover the car more. It handles a bit different in some corner phases, but not too much in a way. So we still don't know exactly where we are. And in the end, what defines the fast car is how much downforce you have overall and how much horsepower in the end we have.
I thought it was interesting that Carlos Sainz came out and said that he thought AlphaTauri were one of McLaren's big challenges this year.
Well, I think it's all remained quite tight in our group. I think it's very hard to say who got those two or three tenths, you know, spare to be in front. It looked like Racing Point, of course, seemed to have made a quite decent step forward. But again, it's not fully clear because everyone still had small differences in program, in the fuel and so on. So it's hard to say. But yeah, I'm sure we can be close to, like it was last year, it was very close between all of us in the midfield. I think it will stay the same way. It will be very close. I just hope we have enough. We are not favorites, I think, to fight for the best of the rest. But even if it's so, it's still important that we have a chance.
Is there a different vibe around the team this year, given that you're now a, what are you? You're a clothing manufacturer, no longer a fizzy drink. Does it feel different in any way? Because the pre-season launch was incredible and great to see some razzmatazz back in Formula One launches. But does it feel the same as last year?
It felt like a year ago already. I don't know. Honestly, yeah, I remember everyone being quite excited. You know, it's a new page in team's history. It's an important step. Of course, Toro Rosso was one thing. Then now we represent a brand fully. So it's quite a different kind of game now for the team. But in a way, yeah, it has changed from branding point of view, from presentation point of view of the team and so on. But technically, we're just an evolution from last year, from 2019. So in that respect, it's my job as a driver, once I get to the track, is just being aware of that. And all the engineers pretty much stayed the same. And the driver lineup, the car is an evolution of last year. So we work on based on that. And then, of course, it's great to be part of a brand.
Hey, Danny, thank you so much for your time. It's been brilliant to chat.
Thank you, Tom. Thanks. Great chat. Ciao, ciao.
He's so straightforward, isn't he? Danny doesn't shy away from any questions. He rationalizes everything and moves on. In fact, it's easy to see why he understands Helmut Marko so well. They are, in some ways, quite similar characters. I love Danny's insights into Russia when he was growing up, as well as his impressive reading list and his utter dedication to achieving his goals in racing, even when there was no history of racing in his family, or let's face it, in his country. Danny's is an inspiring story. He's gracious in defeat and he's magnanimous when successful. And he's becoming increasingly popular in the pit lane. There was even a little cheer in the press room when he finished third at Hockenheim last year.
Keep plugging away, Danny. And as you say, you never know what'll happen. Thanks for your time. It was great to chat. And thanks too to AlphaTauri for teeing it up. Now, just before I leave you for another week, there's just time for the mailbag. I'm so pleased that so many of you enjoyed hearing from driver manager Julian Jacoby last week. His stories about Senna and Prost and everything else were priceless. Just finished the Julian Jacoby episode, says Jonathan Hodges on Twitter. He's very knowledgeable, worked with the best, and he's certainly the best sports agent in the business. Hard to disagree with a lot of what you just said there, Jonathan. I still can't get my head around how he managed Senna and Prost at the same time. Just incredible. Christian Rose also got in touch to say this. Of all 82 episodes, I reckon this has to be my favourite so far. Remarkable stories. Well, I love them all, Christian, like my children. But what Julian had to say was certainly fascinating. And one final thing before I go. I mentioned a new podcast last week, and I want to give it a quick shout out again now. It's called F1 Nation, and I present it with Alex Jakes. Lots of F1 chat and laughs and guests. And episode 2 lands on Friday, the 8th of May. Available on all of your favourite podcast apps. Please let me know your thoughts. For now, though, thanks for listening, and please keep your feedback coming because we love it. I'm at TomClarksonF1 on Twitter, or use the hashtag F1BeyondTheGrid. Beyond the Grid is produced by F1 in association with Audio Boom. Until next time, stay safe, keep washing those hands, and keep it flat out.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.